The latest on Hurricane Irma's track through the Caribbean as it makes its way toward Florida. Also, author and historian Ibram Kendi on the show this morning. Good morning. Hope you're staying calm out there as we watch the approaching storm head our way. We are live from Studio 5, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We're always live on the radio at 9. Also, never miss a show. You can download our podcast on iTunes or through the WJCT app. Just ahead, the latest on Irma. Also, a conversation with best-selling author and historian Ibram Kendi and his award-winning book, Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, we've got a Going Green doubleheader on the show, looking at how you can access electric cars and solar power. Lots to talk about there. A little later on in the show, a preview of a new children's museum in St. Augustine. It's called Tag, like Tag You're It. We'll hear about that too. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, we've got a quick update for you on Hurricane Irma. I know lots of you out there are watching this very closely. And of course, we are too here at 89.9 and WJCT. Now, the Category 5 storm is churning through the Caribbean as we speak, as Floridians brace for the worst. The hurricane is forecast to move north of Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands this afternoon, unleashing very strong winds and heavy rain, but not directly hitting those islands. By Sunday morning, Irma is on track to approach mainland Florida and the Florida Keys. The latest computer models, which project several possible paths for the storm, show Irma could move further to the east, threatening the Carolinas and the East Coast, and of course, our first coast as well. But, you know, it's still just too early to tell how the storm's going to move. There are several possible scenarios the experts are tracking. What can we do? Get our hurricane plan ready now. Download the Florida Storms app right away. Do that today so you can stay in touch with the storm. And visit the website jacksready.com to know whether you live in an evacuation zone. Lots of information on that website just for times like this. We'll be covering the storm all this week here on 89.9 and at WJCTnews.org, so stay tuned to us. We are part of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. We'll be bringing you the latest all this week and weekend on Irma, and also have regular updates from Florida Public Radio meteorologist Jeff Huffman. That's the latest on Irma. All right, in other news this morning, he's one of the nation's best authorities on the history of racism in this country. And he often follows a path many others don't. Ibram Kendi is an assistant professor of African American history at the University of Florida. He studies racist and anti-racist movements from throughout American history, and he's the author of several well-regarded books. In his latest, Stamped from the Beginning, Kendi focuses on what he calls the racism of good intentions and well-meaning by promoting freedom but forgetting equality. And he points to many of those considered heroes over the nation's history, everyone from Abraham Lincoln to Frederick Douglass, W.E.B. Du Bois, President Barack Obama, and more. Ibram Kendi will be giving a lecture tonight at 7 p.m. at the Robinson Theater on the UNF campus. We've got a preview right now as he's on the line ahead of his trip to Jacksonville. Dr. Ibram Kendi, a pleasure, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
And let's hope the forecast stays nice and clear as you get on a plane to come to Jacksonville and talk about these themes. Now, you will be speaking at UNF tonight on this. Getting more deeply into the ideas in your book, Stamped from the Beginning. And there's so much to get into here, but this is an intellectual history of prejudice and racism in America, with the idea that almost all of us hold some kind of racist ideology or ideas in our hearts. And as you write, including those that history has judged as the most well-meaning or as leaders on this issue. Can you tell us a little bit about what motivated the ideas in your book?
Well, first and foremost, I wanted to write a history of ideas, of what I considered racist ideas, which I ultimately defined as any idea that suggests a racial group is superior or inferior to another racial group in any way. And as you know, in our time, many people will say things about particular racial groups and then turn around and say that they're not racist. And I think one of the reasons why many of us are so opinionated about the racial groups, but simultaneously, no matter what we say, we do not believe those ideas to be racist, is because really we have yet to accept a common definition of a racist idea. And so first and foremost, I wanted to do that. I wanted to sort of draw the line between what an idea that is racist and an idea that is actually anti-racist. And so anti-racist ideas suggest racial equality.
And in the telling of this, you cite some people that history doesn't usually regard as racists, everyone from Abraham Lincoln to Frederick Douglass, Barack Obama, W.E.B. Du Bois, Susan B. Anthony. You talk about the racism of well-meaning. Can you explain that concept, the racism of well-meaning?
Sure. So history has largely excluded some of these individuals because of the way history has largely defined a racist idea. And historians typically have defined a racist idea when it came to biology. In other words, if somebody stated that a racial group is biologically distinct and inferior, then that, according to the traditional definition, is a racist idea. Well, I actually expanded a little bit. And so I actually show that notions of not only biological racial hierarchy, but also cultural hierarchy. So when we say a particular racial group is culturally inferior and even behaviorally inferior. And so that's why in my definition, the concept of in any way is crucial. And so those figures that you mentioned would reject notions of biological hierarchy, but they have made cases that black people were in some ways behaviorally or even culturally inferior.
It's 549-2937 to connect with UF historian Ibram Kendi. He'll speak tonight on the UNF campus. And you get deeply into history in this book, Stamped from the Beginning. But these are ideas that have so much currency right now with everything that's going on in this country. What are some of the observations or parallels you can draw as we look at just the way this nation is so deeply divided right now? And the tragedy in Charlottesville, Virginia, is just the latest example of that. Is this something that you'll be touching on tonight?
Yes, and I think we should always try to ask the question of why. Why are we so deeply divided along racial lines? And then I think in reading Stamped from the Beginning, I think people begin to see that what's really dividing us are our ideas about different groups or even our own group is racist ideas. And then what people begin to realize is that there are particular forces in society that are producing these ideas so we can look at each other and not see ourselves in each other. And then we think about, okay, why are they doing that? And so all of these sort of things are things that I tried to sort of get into in the book. And really the central question I think that Americans are dealing with today and are divided over today is the same question Americans were dealing with and divided over at the founding of this nation, and that is, why does racial inequality exist? And there's largely been two answers. There's something wrong with people, or there's something wrong with policies. And Americans have basically divided and argued along those lines.
You also talk about intersectionality in your writing, opposing not just racism, but sexism, homophobia, colorism, nativism, class bias. I mean, can you talk a little bit about the concept of intersectionality and how that informs your thinking on this?
So in the definition racial groups, I'm talking about the fact that the races, let's say the black race or the white race, are really a collection of racial groups. And so, for instance, the black race Black men are a racial group. Black women are a racial group. The black poor are a racial group. And so ideas, racist ideas, have been produced and targeted and suggested that there was something wrong or inferior about each and every one of these groups. And so typically these ideas about race intersect with other forms of bigotry. To give probably an obvious example, elitist ideas suggest that poor people are lazy. And so that's a very old idea among elitist people, saying that, you know, they're the most hardworking and poor people are the most lazy. Well, racist ideas have long suggested that black people are lazy. And so when you combine those two ideas, notions that black poor people are the laziest people emerge.
That's one example. And as we talk with historian Ibram Kendi, what are your questions? 549-2937. Keith is in Riverside this morning. Hey, Keith, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I'm looking forward to attending your talk this evening. My question has to do with, how do you think the attitudes of the leaders in charge impact what happens to the people below? I'm finishing up a manuscript about joining the Navy as a poor black high school dropout and becoming a surface warfare officer in the Navy. And it's not just about me. It's about all of those subgroups that you talk about. And I think if people tell their stories, then that can help eliminate some of this. But what do you think is going to take to change what's happening in the country?
Well, thank you for the question, Keith, and I'm looking forward to seeing you this evening. And so in the book, and Stand from the Beginning, I distinguish between the producers of racist ideas and the consumers. And so I study the people who wrote the book with all of these ideas suggesting that there's something inferior about black people, not necessarily the people who read the book. And so if to speak to your question, if the people who are producing the ideas are the people on top and the people who are consuming them are the people at the bottom, then the question I ask is, why were these people producing these ideas? And I actually found, which is sort of different than what most people have understood about the origins of racism, that these people were typically creating these ideas to justify and defend existing racist policies. And so really it was the policies, discriminatory policies, and the need to defend them that was leading to ideas.
What would be,
as opposed to the other way around.
What would be an example of that?
Sure. So I think to give a contemporary example, there really since 2013 has been a rush of voter ID laws and other new voting laws all across the United States. And courts and scholars have basically shown and argued that these laws have targeted particularly African-American voters with surgical precision, to quote a North Carolina judge. And so then you have these laws, and then what is the reason for the law? To suppress the black vote so that a particular party could maintain office or win office. So therein lies the sort of political self-interest leading to the policy. But then you need to defend those laws. When people ask, why are these laws? You know, why do we need these laws? So then comes the creation of this idea of voter corruption. Ideas that harken back to Reconstruction era notions of black people being corrupt, and that's why we have to strip them of the right to vote. And then people consume these ideas, and then they start believing that there's voter corruption, and then they therefore support those laws as opposed to oppose them.
What's the most common, I don't know, pushback you get when you present these ideas? You know, people say, particularly from white people, what do they say? What's the most common sort of pushback you hear from white folks?
So I think the most common pushback from white folks is the way that I define. So I ended up, so I think to speak earlier, I really identify two kinds of racist ideas. Segregationist ideas, which are more traditional notions that the racial groups are biologically distinct. These are the ideas that people in Charlottesville had. And then what I call assimilationist ideas. And these are the ideas of largely people who are very well-meaning.
These are people who believe the racial groups were created equal, but they believe that black people became inferior as a result of our pathological culture or barbaric Africa or even discrimination and the trauma or the history of discrimination. And so many Americans, many white Americans believe these ideas, that black people are behaviorally inferior because of their condition, because of their environment. And so clearly, for some of them who aren't open to this idea, it's very difficult for them to hear ideas that they've been expressing for quite some time are racist.
Yeah, no one wants to think of themselves as racist.
Exactly. And ironically, every person that I chronicle in Stanford Beginning, they do not consider their ideas to be racist. So that's pretty par for the course.
Yeah, and you quote some of the leading historical figures who have been judged as improving conditions for people of color in this country. Frederick Douglass, Barack Obama. You cite the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education decision. Several key moments in history seen through your prism. You say even these turnkey moments have a racist underpinning. Like, let's talk about 1954, Brown v. Board of Education. What about that particular moment in history? You cite that as well.
So yeah, I think, first of all, we have to distinguish between a court case like that had an anti-racist effect with the underlying ideas that led the judges to decide that segregation was now unconstitutional. And so I think most people have not actually read the Brown decision. And if they read the Brown decision, what they'll read is judges who are basically saying that segregated schools are making black children into inferior beings and are harming them from an educational standpoint. They're not saying that it's both harming black and white children. They're principally talking about the harm that segregation is bringing upon black children. And at the time, there was all of this social science research that was using very small sample sizes, making the case that segregation was literally making black people inferior. And so they leaned on that scientific evidence, for the lack of a better term, and then made their decision. And so I'll actually encourage everyone to actually read the decision, because I thought that they were saying that, oh, they found that the schools were not equal. No, they actually judged the schools to be equal. What they did not judge to be equal were the people.
Hmm. This is just a short preview of what you can hear tonight as author and historian Ibram Kendi of UF visits UNF to talk about his book, Stand from the Beginning, 7 p.m. at the Robinson Theater on the UNF campus. Dr. Kendi, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
All right, and much more still ahead later. A look at a new attraction in St. Augustine, the Children's Museum Tag. We'll tell you about it. Also, up next, how you can test drive some brand new electric cars right here in downtown Jacksonville. We'll be right back.
The clock is ticking for children of undocumented immigrants, hoping that Congress will fix the federal policy known as DACA. But there's much more at stake than politics.
Think about the brain power of 800,000 well-educated young folks.
For many of these young people, America is the only home they've ever known. What happens to them if DACA dies? Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT.
Dig, research, question, repeat. That's what we do every week on Reveal.
I have here thousands of pages of documentation of murder.
I'm Al Ledson, host of Reveal, the weekly radio show from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Reveal, because there's always more to the story.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
If a hurricane threatens our state, Florida's public radio stations have joined forces to ensure you receive important storm information. No matter where you are, you can stay informed on the radio, online, on social media, and on the mobile app, Florida Storms. Timely weather information is always available from WJCT. The Florida Public Radio Emergency Network is supported by Citizens Property Insurance. Online at citizensfla.com.
Sit back, relax, and travel back in time with 89.9 on Sunday nights beginning at 7 with Radio Theater.
The Adventures of Philip Marlowe.
Doo-wop Revival.
Good evening, I'm Glenn Fisher, the king of the doo-woppers.
Relax Radio. Throwback Sunday, Sunday nights beginning at 7 on 89.9 WJCT. Online at WJCT.org. Looking forward to looking back.
Welcome back. Well, lots of sustainability news in today's Going Green here on the show. We're going to start with something that is so cool. It's the fourth annual North Florida Electric Drive Rally. This is coming up next week at Intuition Aleworks in downtown Jacksonville. If you already have an EV, electric vehicle, or you're just curious, you need to come out to this. It's your chance to test drive some really cool electric cars, and there's more on hand. Jeff Sheffield is executive director of the North Florida TPO, and he's here now with a preview. Hey, Jeff.
Good morning.
This sounds like a lot of fun. Beer, food, Intuition Aleworks, Black Sheep's providing some snacks, and electric vehicles to kind of ride and drive around in, right?
It is pretty cool. It's something, like you mentioned, it's our fourth year. We've seen it grow consistently. This is an event right now where we're expecting over 100 so far that have registered for the event. It gives an opportunity not only for those who don't have vehicles to kind of come see them, but it's also a cool opportunity for the owners to come hang out, show off their cars, and have an opportunity to see that. So we're expecting already over 30 different types of vehicles ultimately be there. We've had a huge partnership with our local dealers, our friends at BMW and Tesla will both be out there mm-hmm. with their cars as well to show off, so it should be a lot of fun.
This is coming up again next Wednesday, 5 to 7 p.m. at Intuition Aleworks. This is a free event.
Yep.
Now, there's a lot to talk about when it comes to the growth of EVs mm-hmm. in Northeast Florida. At North Florida TPO, you really track this closely. How do you see this sector growing?
We're seeing it grow significantly on a percentage basis, not on a raw number at this point. And that's just the nature of alternative fuel vehicles. So I think what's really grown it for us is the fact that we now have a network out there of EV charging stations. Mm-hmm. We've had the opportunity to use federal funds to put out about 25 within the JEA service area. And now the TPO has funding to expand that into Nassau, Clay, and St. John's. So it really is giving an opportunity for people to have comfort in knowing that there's electric for their vehicles. And we've seen that then exponentially result in additional vehicles at the dealers and increase in purchases.
Right. If people know that it's convenient to keep that vehicle charged, they'll be more likely to take a chance.
Absolutely.
And
in the state of Florida, actually, in terms of ownerships in the country, Florida ranks fourth in terms of the number of electric vehicles currently as we speak.
Yeah, and as the TPO says, charge well results are electrifying. Now, there are rebates available, too, for
yep.
an EV, isn't there?
There right? is, both at the federal and local level. There's a $7,500 credit, tax credit at the federal level, and the JEA even offers an additional $1,000 rebate as well towards vehicles. So the opportunities are there for to consider it. The price point of vehicles is now there for them to consider it. And so I just think the market is there now for people to look into it.
And when you look at ChargeWell, here is a statistic from JEA, the local utility. ChargeWell users have avoided 16 tons of CO2
yeah.
by choosing an electric vehicle.
Yeah, we've seen of those 20, and I think it's important to understand, when we talk of ChargeWell, that's the specific network that we've put out of 25 stations. But in the Northeast Florida area, there are about 50 when you include Tesla and Nissan and other superchargers. So there's a huge network out there. But yeah, our system alone has done that. We've seen over 8,000 individual charging sessions on those 25 units, and that's just been since the early part of 2016. So we see it.
And you can go to the North Florida TPO website just to look at the map of all of the ChargeWell-branded charging stations all around town, a couple dozen of them. Now, as electric vehicles continue to come down in price, the idea, I guess, is that more people will buy them. As of right now, though, there is sort of a price barrier. There are plenty more people that want one than can afford to buy one.
Absolutely. And we're seeing that, though, in some models. I think most have heard, obviously, Tesla being the popular brand. I think everyone's aware that a model is coming out that it's more at a price point. But we're seeing it in a number of vehicles. So there is the opportunity for folks to come into a market in the $25,000 to $35,000 range, which is not out of the realm of the typical vehicle that folks are purchasing. Mm-hmm. And you're also, now you're getting them with batteries that have quite a bit more miles into the charge. So the comfort level across the board is there.
When people come out to this drive rally next week, will they get to test drive whichever one strikes their fancy?
There'll be a few out there. BMW, again, is one that is most willing, and they'll have a lot of their i3s and others for people to drive. The Tesla dealers will be out there as well. And I think one of the things that we want to make sure, though, is even though it's free, we very much want people to actually register so we have some records of it. So we would encourage them to go to driveelectricrally.com and register. And whether you make it or not, if you think you're going to come, please register so we have the opportunity to have that information. But it's a good time, and there's some pretty cool cars out there to take a look at.
Have you had a chance to take any out for a spin?
I have, actually. I have my eye on a BMW that...
There you go.
Yeah, and it fits that price point that we were speaking of.
Is that something you'd consider buying for yourself?
It's my next car.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, it is my next car. Although I do keep my cars for a long time, but it is my next car. I have full faith now in its function and ability. I'm confident in it. Frankly, I'm confident in it with or without the charging network that's out there now. When you see that over 80% of users are charging at home, those batteries are allowing them to commute. The network itself is just creating a comfort level.
If you're just tuning in, it's our Going Green on the show as we speak with Jeff Sheffield, Executive Director of North Florida TPO, that's Transportation Planning Organization. Their Drive Electric Rally is coming up next Wednesday night, September 13th, 5 o'clock at the Downtown Intuition Ale Works. What are your questions about EVs, electric vehicles? 549-2937. Jacob is in St. Augustine. Hey, Jacob. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I just have a quick question about the tax credits for purchasing an electric vehicle. Do those apply only to new electric vehicle purchases, or does it apply if you're buying a used electric vehicle as well?
I'll be honest, I don't know the answer to that. It's not my expertise, to be quite frank, I'm not sure.
According to JEA's website, if you're buying or leasing a new EV, they provide a rebate through the utility.
Okay.
So for JEA, at least,
at the federal
it's
level,
be
I
new.
don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, and according to what they're telling us, Jacob, rebates available for any qualifying plug-in EV purchased on or after September 18th, 2014. And so that's through JEA. But I'll check on the federal question.
Yeah, I apologize.
Yeah, that's a good question. Thank you, Jacob. Anything else people need to know about the big event?
No. I would, just come out and hang out. It's a cool time. And it is the opportunity for you to drive some really neat cars and decide if it's something that catches your eye down the road.
Here's an email from Rob in Murray Hill for us. Our family installed solar a year ago. We have saved 18,000 pounds of carbon in 1 year. We have a Model 3 on order as it is the next step in EV clean energy. Even our lawnmowers, weed trimmers, and chainsaws are now solar powered by charging the lithium batteries by solar. Thanks for that, Rob. We're going to talk about solar in a minute here, but let's take one more call. Mark is in Orange Park. Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm going to ask my question. How do the batteries get their charge? Where do they get their energy from?
Excuse me?
Well, you plug the car in and you charge the battery just like you charge any battery.
Yeah. Right. Where does that energy come from?
The grid, you know, the power grid.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
So isn't that going to eventually tax the grid?
Okay. So what about that?
Absolutely. I mean, this is still not a completely clean system, if you will. I think, but when we are looking at the movement from an alternative fuels perspective, our initiative goes beyond the EV. We're looking at natural gas. We're looking at propane. We're looking at both compressed and liquid natural gas. So it's not a perfect zero system at this point, but in every case, it is an improvement from the current use of petroleum in the country. And so everywhere you can displace petroleum consumption, you are progressing in the movement, not only from an environmental perspective. I think what's important to understand in this whole alt-fuels movement, if you will, is the benefit to the environment, but the business model have both converged now, and I think that's why we're seeing this movement. Much of this investment is happening now at the private sector level because the business model is working for fuel consumption in these alt fuels. And so now that that has happened, it's been married with the environmental benefits.
Two types of green there.
It is.
Yeah.
And you know, depending on, I mean, alt fuels and those conversations have been here for a very long time, but the math didn't work. And now it does, and so now the benefits to the environment have now come into play, and the conversations now are happening across the board.
It's going to be an exciting time. Come on out next Wednesday night at 5 o'clock to downtown Intuition Ale Works for the 4th Annual Drive Electric Rally. Check out some EVs, drive them around, have some beer and snacks, and meet Jeff Sheffield. He's such a great guy.
Thank you.
The Executive Director of North Florida TPO, sponsor on the show, by the way. And thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, so from EVs on the roads to solar on your rooftop. Florida Solar United Neighborhoods, or FLSUN, expands access to solar by educating Floridians about the benefits of solar energy. It does everything from help organize group solar installations to work on better solar policies for Florida. This group has a new co-op in St. Johns County, and they're holding an information session next week. Here with more, Angela DeMondbrun, Executive Director of FLSUN. Good to see you.
Thank you, Melissa.
And Warren Clark, a sponsor of the event with Compassionate St. Augustine. Hey, Warren.
Great to be here.
Thanks for being with us. Angela, let's start with you. St. Johns County has joined other Florida counties in putting together a solar co-op. What's this all about?
So a solar co-op is essentially a group of homeowners that come together. FLSUN facilitates the entire process, but they come together and it's like a group bulk purchasing program. And they sign up on their website, in this case, www.flsun.org. They can simply go under St. Johns County and sign up. And then after we have a critical number of about 30 to 40 homeowners, we facilitate an RFP process. The group selects an installer to serve, and installations start happening.
How much interest is there in St. Johns County? Warren Clark, you're based in St. Augustine. Mm-hmm. How much interest in St. Johns?
There's a lot of interest in St. Johns. We've had the co-op open for about a month. We have over 100 people that have signed up that say that they want to get a bid from the installer that we select, which we'll be selecting tomorrow night. And so this process is really moving along.
Nice. So a lot of people want to check out solar on their home or business.
Yes, they do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yeah, here in Duval, of course, there was a lot of excitement about the new IKEA store hiring, I think it's A1A Solar, to put solar on the IKEA rooftops.
Right.
You're trying to pool resources of individual homeowners and business owners so that they can leverage their purchasing power to buy solar. Is that how it works, basically?
Essentially, when we have a group, a good number, 30 to 40, we issue the RFP, and it helps the market in and around the co-ops. We send out the RFP to installers locally and statewide, and they're able to see, okay, this is a group that's moving forward, they're ready to go, and the installer can bring down their price because it's kind of like going to Costco or Sam's. Mm-hmm. You have a good group of people, and meaning we facilitate the entire process, conduct roof reviews. We come into the community, in this case, St. Johns County. We host solar information sessions. We give them the basic information and the tools, taking the intimidation out of going solar. And then so when the installer knocks on their door, they're ready to go and make a well-informed decision.
They're ready. Oh, go ahead, Warren.
Hey, Melissa, that is really what drew me to this. I'm an average homeowner, not somebody that has a whole lot of expendable money to use.
Like most people, yeah.
Like most people. And so it was like, when I looked at the ticket price on this, it was like, I don't think I can afford that. Then when I asked a different question, how much am I spending each month for electricity? How long would it take me to pay off just with that same amount of money that I'm spending for electricity each month? And it came out to 7 to about 11 years, depending on what you put on your roof. And then I looked at, wow, so I'm making an investment for myself. I'm building equity on this on my roof that I will get back when I sell my house, because that'll add value to my house. And then on top of that, by doing this together as a group, that I'm going to get probably about a 20% discount as compared to buying it individually. And then there's a 30% federal tax credit on top of that, so that after I put the panels on my roof, I have about a 45% equity in the panels that are up there already, that when I sell the house, that's going to be coming back. And then that also makes my house more valuable to somebody who says, you know, I like it that I can buy a house. I don't have to pay an electricity
bill. Of course, sure.
And it's contributing to the environment and to local jobs.
And
that
so,
all fit for me as an average homeowner to want to go to Florida Sun and say, could we do this in St. Johns County with Compassionate St. Augustine?
And so there's a ringing endorsement from you, Warren. If your interest is piqued, you need to come out to the St. Johns County Co-op Information Meeting on Solar. It's next week, September 13th, Wednesday, 7 p.m. at the Village Church at World Golf Village, all to educate St. Johns County about solar and joining the co-op process. Go to flsun.org for more. Fascinating stuff. Keep us posted, guys.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Angela DeMonbrun, Executive Director of FL Sun, Warren Clark with Compassionate St. Augustine. Again, that is next Wednesday night at World Golf Village at the Village Church. And we'll be right back.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
In America, you're free to believe whatever you want. Author Kurt Anderson says that's made us the world capital for conspiracies, scam artists, and alternative facts.
A quarter of Americans believe that vaccines cause autism and that the government today is hiding natural cures for cancer.
Kurt Anderson on his new book, Fantasyland, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Now, I had a boyfriend. He was going for a Cat Stevens look, but it doesn't really work when you have a retainer. He also had a tendency to refer to me as m'lady.
Join us next time for more True Stories Told Live. This week, camp, cars, cockroaches, and the Kremlin on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturdays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday through Saturday nights on 89.9 when we bring you music from around the world. All styles played, all songs considered. Join me for the Electro Lounge, Tuesday through Saturday nights.
Welcome back. Well, the First Coast has made strides in recent years in reducing its infant mortality rate, but it's still a serious health concern in this area. Too many of our babies are dying before their first birthday because of preventable causes and a lack of health services. Each year in this area, we are losing the equivalent of 8 classes of kindergartners to infant mortality. Now, September is National Infant Mortality Awareness Month. Faye Johnson has some insights. She is CEO of the Northeast Florida Healthy Start Coalition. Hey, Faye.
Hey, good morning.
And I'd know for some time that we have an infant mortality rate in Northeast Florida that's almost like a third world country in some respects, way too high. Correct. What's driving that?
Well, Melissa, unfortunately, in the Northeast Florida area, we have 3 major contributing factors that are associated with infant mortality. One is the unhealthy weight of a woman prior to pregnancy and during pregnancy, and also the spacing. We would like for our moms, prior to getting pregnant the next time, to space their children at least 18 months apart to have a healthy birth outcome. And then also, one of the major contributing factors is disparities by race. In certain areas, because of the social determinants of health, it has impacted and is responsible for the infant mortality rate.
And this is sort of a canary in the coal mine, isn't it? Yes, public health people say if the infant mortality rate is high in a community, that's a sure sign that the overall health of the community is not good.
That is correct. That is correct. We really see, like I said, even though people associate and everyone associates infant mortality with just health, but it's more than that. It's the social determinants of health that are impacting the outcomes, whether it's poor housing, whether it's transportation, whether it's being able to be employed and education. All those things impact the health of a mother.
Right. If you live in a high crime neighborhood, yes. If you have asthma, diabetes, hypertension, we have really high rates of those too. So,
correct.
So given that September is Infant Mortality Awareness Month, you want to raise awareness about this through the Northeast Florida Healthy Start, yes, Coalition, and what's being done, certainly, here in Duval County to address this? Because it's my understanding that there's been a coordinated effort for, yes, years to work on this issue,
yes, yes,
in Jacksonville.
Yeah, that is correct. The Northeast Florida Healthy Start Coalition started in 1991, and since that time, we've had a 35% decrease in the infant mortality rate. However, it's still higher than the state rate and the national rate. So through the Northeast Florida Healthy Start Coalition, we lead a cooperative effort of pulling organizations together to provide a lot of different services. And also within that, our three main focus areas are saving babies, strengthening communities, and also building communities. So with that, we're just not focusing on just on the health of the mother. We're pulling a lot of agencies together. We also have an initiative around the Leadership Academy, which is a grassroots advocacy piece, too, because the laws and things impact infant mortality as well.
So there's a policy aspect to this, too.
Yes.
What's the biggest policy change, do you think, that would make the most difference?
Sure. Well, one of the policy changes, as well as you know, expanding Medicaid to the state of Florida. We, our women, a lot of them, not all, because the Healthy Start program is not only for low-income women, it's for all women. But we do see access to health being a major factor in having insurance impacts the ability for individuals to receive care.
Lack of insurance still,
yes,
such an issue.
Yes, it is.
Where can people learn more about this?
They can learn more about going to, calling the Northeast Florida Healthy Start Coalition at 904-723-5422 and definitely visiting our website at www.northeastfloridahealthystart.org anytime.
September is National, yes, Infant Mortality Awareness Month. Thanks for raising this awareness.
Thank you so much.
She's Faye Johnson, CEO of Northeast Florida Healthy Start Coalition. Okay, we're going to keep talking about kids right now. Finally this hour, it's a new and exciting space to take your children. The TAG Children's Museum is opening up soon in St. Augustine. Executive Director Kim McEwen is here to tell us about it. Hey, TAG, you're it, Kim.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you.
Good to see you. I've heard so much about this. Now, we have a children's museum in Jacksonville. This is a brand new offering in St. Johns County. Tell us about TAG, and it's TAG with an exclamation point.
That's right.
Yeah.
TAG, you're it. TAG, like the game that you play. We all played when we were kids. So our grandparents played it, we play it, and our children play it. But the meaning behind the name is it's playful and playful learning, and that's what TAG's all about. So it's also an acronym for teaching and growing and thinking about green, which ties into your previous guest, and also think about giving. So it's a great name, and we're very excited.
How did this all come about, the impetus for a children's museum in St. Augustine?
Well, as is often the case, five amazing women in our community came together and created the 501c3, sat down at their kitchen table and put the plans in motion to create a children's museum for Northeast Florida.
Where is it going to be located? When's it going to be open?
Oh, those are great questions. So it is located right next door to Target Superstore in St. Augustine. We purchased 4 acres of land near the San Sebastian River. There's a new shipyard marine community being built there. It's actually ship storage, and we'll have a hotel and restaurants. And we purchased 4 of the 50-acre development. And we hope to open, start construction this fall, and we should be open by next summer.
By next summer.
Yes.
And you want people from not just the historic city, but from all over the region to visit. Who's the target audience for TAG?
Absolutely. So residents and community members of Northeast Florida and our educators, homeschoolers. We would look forward to having many field trips and birthday parties and really cater to. This is built for the community, for the residents of Northeast Florida. And of course, we are a big draw for tourism too. So we want our visitors to come because we have history and culture, health and wellness, environmental stewardship, all of these things that are taught tie in to Florida, and it helps us to tell the story of our region.
When kids come through with their folks, with their parents, what's the experience going to be like?
Well, children's museums are places where children become the guide. So they're hands-on learning, very active. We'll have a maker's gallery, an art gallery, and a STEAM gallery. So it's all about science, technology, engineering, art, and math. Very active play. But as our education director says, they set learning traps everywhere. So children are having a blast and playing and interactive and making and innovating, but they're also learning.
Children's museums are designed with science in mind, too, aren't they? Just a better understanding of how children's brains get built and developed from birth to age 5.
Correct.
How will TAG help in that area?
So oftentimes when we meet with teachers, they explain that they have a very limited time for those deep dive into the science experience and the way to teach the methods. And so at a children's museum, the children get to take as much time as they want. There's no rush. There's no test at the end. So it kind of opens up the opportunity for them to discover what ignites them and what they find their interest.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a way people can learn more about this, because this weekend in St. Augustine, it just so happens to be the host of an event called the Spanish Wine Festival. Right off the bat, I'm just so interested in maybe driving down for the weekend. You are going to be one of the beneficiaries of this big wine festival. What's going to be happening?
So this is the 6th annual wine festival in St. Augustine, and it's a Friday, Saturday, Sunday event. And on Sunday, it benefits TAG Museum, and it's a grand tasting. We have 100 different wines and appetizers, and tickets are still on sale through Thursday. Of course, we're keeping a close eye on the storm, and we'll be making those decisions tomorrow night.
And it may not happen.
Right.
But we're going to have to watch.
Right now, we're moving forward, and we're excited, and we're just so honored to yet again be a participant in this event. It's a great time for St. Augustine.
Right. So people need to go to the website to buy tickets, SpanishWineFestival.com. But as you said, we're going to have to keep such a close eye on the storm. We just don't. It's so hard to make plans right now. But hopefully with a little luck, our weekend can proceed normally. And in the meantime, how can people learn more about the progress of this museum?
You can visit tagmuseum.org, and please look at, if you're on social media, visit our Facebook page and follow us. We have a lot of announcements there. We do have workshops from time to time, and we're prototyping exhibits, and we'd love for you and your family to come meet us and stop by and learn more about it, and sign up for our newsletter.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Kim McEwen. She heads up the new TAG Children's Museum. It will hopefully be open next summer in St. Augustine. That's the schedule. Thanks for the update.
Thank you.
And that is our show. A lot of you out there, I know, are very concerned about Hurricane Irma. Here's another quick update. It's packing winds of 185 miles per hour and made landfall in the Caribbean island of Barbuda about 2 a.m. this morning, according to the National Hurricane Center. By 8 a.m., it was passing over St. Martin and making its way through the Caribbean. It's expected to make landfall in Florida by the weekend. President Trump has declared a state of emergency in Florida. We're going to continue following the path of the storm here throughout the week and weekend here on 89.9. Just keep it tuned to us, because we are part of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. We'll be here, our whole news team, all this week and weekend, tracking the path of the storm. And here's another tip for you. Download the Florida Storms app. That is a quick and easy way to get updated information on Irma. You can also go to this website put together by the City of Jacksonville. It's jacksready.com, jacksready.com. Now, on that website, there's a lot of information, but one really important piece is a map of hurricane evacuation zones. In the event an evacuation is ordered for parts of our listening area, you need to know your zone. This is the easiest way to research that. Just go to jacksready.com. We'll continue to bring you updates on Irma through the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Just stay with WJCT. That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board, and the show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app to listen. You can hear our rebroadcast tonight at 8 as well. Next on 1A, why hundreds of thousands of protected undocumented immigrants now are living in limbo. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be back tomorrow at 9 a.m. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.